This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Reading History, The Hanging at Mankato, a performance in conversation with writer Claire Barliant, film editor Anne Barliant, poet and critic Alan Gilbert, and artist David Levine. The event was organized by Triple Canopy. It took place on June 30th, 2011.
I was not in the first fight at New Ulm on August 19th, nor the first attack on Fort Ridgely on August 20th. Here let me say that the Indian names of these and other places in Minnesota are different from the English names. St. Paul is the White Rock. Minneapolis is the place where the water falls. New Ulm is the place where there is a cottonwood grove on the river. Fort Ridgely was the soldier's house. Birch Coulee was called Birch Creek, etc.
It was the fall of 2006. My mother was visiting me in New York and updating me on various distant relatives who live in the Midwest. She was telling me about our cousin, Helene Leaf, who was researching a Lutheran church founded in East Union, Minnesota, by my great-great-great-uncle, Peter Carlson. I wasn't paying close attention, then something cut through the static. Our cousin had learned that another great-great-great-uncle had served in the Union Army during the Civil War. At one point, my mother said, this uncle was present at the execution of several Indians and became physically sick from the sight. Despite having grown up about 400 miles away in Chicago, I had never heard of any such execution, and neither had my mother, nor, as I soon discovered, almost anyone else I mentioned it to. The story stayed with me, so much so, in fact, that I began to think I'd grown up with it. In my memory, it shifted into that category of something I'd known all my life. A cursory Google search only piqued my interest. Based on the few facts I had to go on, I quickly ascertained that the execution my ancestor had witnessed was the largest mass execution to ever take place in the U.S. While posted in Mankato, Minnesota, in the winter of 1862, Anders Johan Carlson stood guard as the U.S. Army hung 38 Dakota after quelling a six-week-long uprising during which over 400 settlers and an unknown number of Indians were killed. With the minimal information I had gathered from the internet, a story began to take shape. When the scaffold fell from the Dakota's feet and the nooses tightened around their throats, a resounding cry went up from the crowd of 1,000 who had gathered to watch the hanging. Carlson, as well as several other troops, was repulsed by the sight of inert bodies suspended from the gallows, swinging like pendulums. He became physically ill, turning away and vomiting. Over a year later, my mother informed me that our cousin had discovered that Anders Johan, who went by AJ, had written an account of his experiences as a soldier for a local newspaper. When I got copies of these papers, which my cousin, Helene Leaf, had diligently photocopied at the Minnesota Historical Society, I scoured them for confirmation of the story I had imagined, but I was out of luck. Though Carlson described his life as a soldier in great detail, he relied on third-party sources to describe the execution, seemingly erasing his own presence. I tried to confirm the story by looking up other accounts, but other troops and bystanders, oftentimes writing years after the execution, described the event impersonally, as if it were only mildly unusual, reflecting that it had inspired in them some feeling of triumph and personal satisfaction. I've only come across one account that captures the trauma of seeing 38 men die simultaneously, an essay submitted to a Minnesota Tourism Bureau contest by a 71-year-old woman in 1933. The execution, she allows, was an awful spectacle for a girl of 15 to witness.
I remember growing up with it, thinking it was such an odd thing. I have always called it the spoon of atrocities.
I'm Wes Cowan, and I'm meeting Nancy to take a look at what she's found.
It's an attractive silver spoon. It has scrolling and flowers, but then across the top of it, it says, Hanging 38 Sioux in 1862, Mankato, Minnesota. Underneath it has a grisly scene.
Some sort of gallows in the middle of the town, with people lined up around it. Where did you get this spoon?
I inherited it from my grandmother, Stella Curry.
And where was Stella from?
from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Nancy, what do you want me to find out about this spoon?
I've always wondered about it. What was going on in the country at that time that they'd make a spoon about such a tragic event?
Between 1898 and 1900, A.J. Carlson wrote nearly 40 articles, some of which are missing because the archives are incomplete, for the East Union News. Carlson's writing is clear and direct, with occasional flashes of that dry, self-deprecating wit so specific to Scandinavian Midwesterners. About joining the army, he writes,
"As usual, the Swedes had to take a back seat when selecting the officers, and consequently, your scribe was mustered in as high private in the rear rank.
But when he reaches the moment of the execution, he simply bows out. After describing how his company was ordered to march to Mankato from where they were stationed in Glencoe, about 40 miles away, to assist in the hanging, all he offers by way of explanation for his silence is this.
The next morning, December 26th, we started from Mankato 6 or 7 miles distant and arrived there about 9 a.m. I will now let another author speak about the tragic event more fully, partly from the Mankato record published at the time and also from official records.
This caesura mystified me. Why was he unable to relate his own experience of witnessing the execution? Why did he opt for a postmodern, or literally pre-modern, method of pastiche? Instead of telling a story from his own point of view, Carlson pieced together a narrative from the dominant source materials, namely newspaper accounts and orders from the commanding officers regarding martial law and the prohibition of liquor sales. His own observations are absent. Some background is needed to begin to understand his reticence, although it is not easy to compress the history of relations between Indians and settlers in Minnesota, which is complex to say the least. In the 1600s and 1700s, French traders and Dakotas lived in Minnesota in relative peace, trading beaver hides and often intermarrying. The real strife began when Scandinavian and German settlers started arriving in Minnesota in the early 1800s and quickly began encroaching on the Dakotas' hunting grounds, which they desired as farmland. Starting in 1805, one land cession followed another, and in 1851, the Dakota, who then numbered about 6,000, agreed to live along the Minnesota River on a strip of land 140 miles long, with 10 miles extending from each side of the river's banks. Corruption among the Indian agents meant that the Dakota were often cheated of their annuities, a fund that was further threatened with the onset of the Civil War. Then, in 1858, the Dakotas gave up their land on the north side of the river, an event that many historians see as a final straw, a combination of humiliation from being defrauded of their lands and desperation from lack of food impelled a group of Dakota to attempt to overthrow their occupation and fail. 400 Indians were taken into custody and put on trial. The trials preceding the execution were hasty and unscrupulous affairs, often lasting no more than 5 minutes, with as many as 40 cases dispatched in a single day. Abraham Lincoln intervened on behalf of the Dakota, reducing the number of men sentenced to death from 303 to 38. While the men were put in prison, the rest of the Dakota tribe, about 1,600 people, was forced to walk to a prison camp near St. Paul, where they struggled to survive in dire conditions for 4 months. More than 200 Dakotas died that winter. In the spring of 1863, the remaining Dakotas, now numbering about 1,300, were herded quite literally like cattle by steamboat and rail hundreds of miles to rough, unknown territory in what is now South Dakota. I failed to find, either in the archives of the Minnesota Historical Society or interviews with historians, evidence to support the story of Carlson's visceral reaction to the execution. But I did begin to understand his resistance to describing an event that, even just 40 years later, was already out of sync with the founding mythology of manifest destiny. Such brutal savagery, and I refer to the public hanging, not the casualties of war, could not be fully absorbed by a narrative that was more intent on celebrating Minnesota's heroic pioneers and the young state's pivotal role in the Civil War. Perhaps my uncle believed he had only one way to deal with a hanging, not by relating his own experience, but by viewing it through a scrim of official records and documents that justified and also in a way that is hard to explain, obscured its occurrence.
I was born in the Indian village of my father near Mendota in 1827, and am now 67 years old. My father was Gray Iron, a sub-chief of the Midawa Zankton Sioux. When he died, I succeeded him as chief of the band and adopted the name of his father, Wamdatonka, which, as is commonly called, means the Big Eagle. When I was a young man, I often went with war parties against the Chippewa and other enemies of my nation, and the six feathers shown in the headdress of my picture in the Historical Society at St. Paul stand for six Chippewa scalps that I took when on the warpath. By the terms of the treaties of the Traverse des Sioux and Mendota in 1851, the Sioux sold all of their lands in Minnesota, except a strip 10 miles wide on each side of the Minnesota River, from near Fort Ridgely to the Big Stone Lake. The Mattawakontons and the Wakotas had their reservation up to Yellow Medicine. In 1858, the 10 miles of this strip belonging to the Mattawakonton and the Wakota bands and lying north of the river were sold, mainly through the influence of Little Crow. That year, with some other chiefs, I went to Washington on business connected with the treaty. The selling of that strip north of the Minnesota caused great dissatisfaction among the Sioux, and Little Crow was always blamed for the part he took in the sale. It caused us all to move to the south side of the river, where there was but very little game, and many of our people, under the treaty, were induced to give up the old life and go work like white men, which was very distasteful to many.
One reason for myself enlisting in the Volunteer Army was the breaking out of the Indian War in the Northwest, principally in Minnesota, which will be the principal subject of my reminiscences at this time. 35 years ago, August 20th, will be remembered by the old settlers that are yet among the living as the day when, late in the evening, the rumor came that the Indians were killing the white settlers and were coming down the Henderson Road, fast approaching East Union, burning and killing everything in their way.
One of my areas of expertise is Western history and art, and I'm pretty sure I've seen a similar image. I just want to check one thing here. Yep, there it is. The image on Nancy's spoon looks remarkably close to a lithograph I once auctioned. The image portrays a December day in 1862 when 38 Dakota, known as Sioux to the white settlers, were hanged in the nation's largest mass execution. Documenting the event with a lithograph is one thing, but why would someone have created such a delicate and ornate spoon featuring the hangings? I'm heading to southern Minnesota and the nearby town of New Ulm. The Brown County Historical Society there has extensive archives about the Minnesota River Valley and its frontier past. Newspapers from the summer of 1862 are filled with reports from the nation's ongoing bloody civil war. I quickly discover local headlines that take the place of the national. On August 17th, hundreds of Dakota warriors, led by Chief Little Crow, took the countryside by surprise, killing white settlers, including women and children. These are some letters, eyewitnesses' accounts of the war. The Indians have made a desert of the country. Such a terrible excitement I never saw nor wish again to see. Women and children were raving around like maniacs, crying for husbands and fathers. When we left home, the report was that the Indians were burning New Ulm. Brutal battles in New Ulm, Fort Ridgely, and Woodlake followed. Ultimately, U.S. troops under Colonel Henry Sibley's command forced the Dakota to surrender, but not before 500 to 800 men, women, and children had died. The Sioux Uprising, or U.S.-Dakota War, as it is also known, was unprecedented in its size and bloody toll. A few months later, 38 Dakota were hanged at Mankato. I've seen souvenir spoons before, and I'm pretty sure this is what Nancy has, but I've never seen such a disquieting image on one before.
Like a destructive storm, the war struck suddenly and spread rapidly. Everything was confusion. It was difficult to know who was friend and who was foe. Little Crow wanted to make peace, but the majority of the people wanted him to lead them in a war. At a council meeting, they threatened him and called him a coward until he in anger agreed to lead them in war. During the war, my husband and I fled to Canada. When we returned, we were imprisoned for 3 years. Our treatment was terrible. All the food was mixed in one big pot, and it wasn't fit to eat. Three of my brothers died of smallpox while in prison. So many Indians have lied about their savings, the lives of white people, that I dislike to speak of what I did. But I did save the life of George H. Spencer at the time of the massacre. Once after that, I kept a half-breed family from being murdered. These are all the people whose lives I claim to have saved. I was never present when the white people were willfully murdered. I saw all the dead bodies at the agency. Mr. Andrew Merrick, a trader with an Indian wife, had refused some hungry Indians credit a short time before when they asked him for some provisions. He said to them, "Go and eat grass." Now he was lying on the ground dead, with his mouth stuffed full of grass, and the Indians were saying tauntingly, "Merrick is eating grass himself."
I meet Waziatuin, a Dakota activist and academic who helped establish the annual march to commemorate the execution, in a cheerful, tidy cafe in the tiny town of Granite Falls, about 100 miles from the border of South Dakota. A historian at the Smithsonian recommended I read Waziatuin's books and articles on the Dakota conflict. In recent years, she has emerged as a fearless activist for the rights of the Dakota people. In 2008, she published a book called What Does Justice Look Like?, which argues the return of public land in Minnesota, amounting to about 12 million acres, among other forms of reparation, such as relief from personal debts. In the book, she refers to white people by the Dakota word Wasisu. While delivering a speech in November 2010 to a group of students at Winona State University, Waziatuin said the Dakota needed to reclaim their land, quote, "by any means necessary," a comment that earned the attention of the FBI. In person, Waziatuin has an unassuming demeanor. She hardly looks like the type of hardcore radical who would make the most wanted list. If anything, she comes across as maternal, or maybe the cool professor who all the kids love, and that is in fact what she is. She is Indigenous Peoples Research Chair at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She has an easy and infectious smile and greets me warmly, telling me to call her Waz. The cafe is filled with tchotchkes for sale. We sit underneath several plaques mounted on the wall, bearing triacly platitudes such as, "A mother's love is like seed scattered in the garden." I apologize for pulling her away from her family. She had been working in her yard just before she arrived, and we banter briefly about chores before delving into the interview. The first question is launches directly into the heart of the matter about why I'm here and what I'd like to talk to you about, which is the execution and the sort of the personal history versus the official history. So I wanted to ask you if you wouldn't mind telling me when you first heard about or learned about the forced evacuation or the execution.
Right. A lot of these episodes in Dakota history are stories or take the form of stories that have been passed on in Dakota families for a very long time. And storytelling, because it's a part of family life and everyday life, there's no point, in fact, when I can look back and say I didn't know the stories then, because I think I grew up with them from the time I was born. And one of the things that I tell people when they ask about the oral tradition and ask about how it is that I learned about these events or at what age I learned about these events, I tell a story about my own daughter when she was just a baby, and she's now almost 20 years old, so it was quite a long while ago. And it was actually one of the last memories I have of my grandmother when she was still living. And I was getting ready to go off to graduate school out in New York, and so I knew I was going to be away from family for a while. And I brought my daughter and my family to see my grandmother on one last trip. And one of the final pictures we have of my grandmother is of her sitting my daughter, who's just a baby at the time, on her lap, and she started talking about 1862. And at that point, it hit me pretty clearly that I've heard these stories my whole life, that what I was seeing was surely the same thing that my father saw when I was a baby sitting on my grandmother's lap. And so I don't know that there was ever a time when I didn't know these things or wasn't aware of them.
Chris says our spoon dates to several decades after the hangings in 1862.
This handle didn't show up until about 1900.
And he agrees the image of 38 Dakota executed at the gallows hardly seems like a likely hometown souvenir.
The scene in the bowl you hardly ever see.
Why would this image appear on a souvenir spoon made so long after the event? And what sparked the Dakota uprising? I'm headed to Milford Township to meet Dakota elder and historian Dr. Eldon Lawrence. He says the Minnesota Rebellion was simmering long before the violence erupted.
Well, it began with the 1851 treaty, in which the Dakota people ceded about 24 million acres of land that was their prime hunting and gathering area. That was kind of the beginning of the end.
Several thousand Native Americans were living on Minnesota's western frontier when it became the 32nd state in 1858. Eldon explains that as European settlers encroached on their hunting grounds, the Dakota were compelled to sign a series of treaties that ceded millions of acres to the U.S. government. In exchange, the Dakota were promised cash annuities, but were forced to give up an ancient way of life.
They were expected to change almost overnight, and a lot of them didn't even know anything about farming.
By 1862, some 7,000 Dakota were confined to tiny reservations along the Minnesota River Valley.
By that spring, they were in starving condition, and they were in great need of the annuities that the government was supposed to provide them, and that was about in June.
Things came to a head in August, when the cash-strapped government, embroiled in the Civil War, was 3 months late on their annuity payments. Indian agent Thomas J. Galbraith refused to distribute food to the hungry Indians without payment. One trader was heard to say of the starving Dakota, "If they're hungry, let them eat grass."
I switch off the microphone and we talk about the Minnesota River Valley and how beautiful it is. Out of some sense of obligation, or perhaps for masochistic reasons best left unexplored at this juncture, I brought my mother, who lives in Chicago and volunteered to join me on this trip, to the interview. For the most part, she is quietly helpful. She listens intently throughout, takes pictures of Waz while she answers my questions, and now says how difficult it is to hear about the treatment of the Dakota. Waz tells us about the new power plant, Big Stone 2, which had recently been built near the plantation, and how the Sioux didn't even bother to protest because they felt so powerless, they didn't think anything they did would prevent its construction. "I have a friend who grew up in New Ulm," my mother says, and she had never heard of the hanging. Feeling relaxed now that the interview is over, I agree with my mother, saying, "I had never heard of it until I found out about my ancestors' memoirs. And whenever I asked my friends about it, they had never heard of it either." Waz nods and smiles tightly, then stands up. She is no longer smiling. "I hope this was helpful," she says simply and politely. My mother shakes her hand and says what a pleasure it was to meet her. I do the same. Then Waz thanks us for the coffee and walks out of the cafe. I stare at a plaque quoting Ecclesiastes chapter 3, "For everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven, etc." and feel like an idiot.
At once, 40 of us were ordered out with 10 days' rations to make a circuit west as far as Lake Preston, 30 miles away. On the third day, we came to the lake, which was one of the most beautiful little lakes I have seen. It was nearly round, with a small island in the center, and the sandy shores and its clear water with fish and fowl in abundance, and surrounded with a small strip of heavy white oak timber. A farmer named White, with his wife and daughter, lived about half a mile to the south, had returned to their farm, the only settlers that had yet returned. All were murdered early the next morning. The old folks were found dead in the house, but the girl they had brought with them was found dead by our boys in a most horrible condition, some 5 or 6 miles off. This was the last murder committed near Glencoe by the Indians.
My grandmother, Isabel Roberts, Maza Okai Win is her Indian name, and her family were taken as captives down to Fort Snelling. On the way, most of them walked, but some of the older ones and the children rode in a cart. When they came through New Ulm, they threw cans, potatoes, and sticks. They went on through the town anyway. The old people were in the cart. They were coming to the end of the town, and they thought they were out of trouble. Then there was a big building at the end of the street. The windows were open. Someone threw hot, scalding water on them. The children were all burned and the old people too. As soon as they started to rub their arms, the skin just peeled off. Their faces were like that too. The children were all crying. Even the old lady started to cry. It was so hard, it really hurt them. But they went on. It was on this trip that my maternal grandmother's grandmother was killed by white soldiers. Up to today, we don't even know where my grandmother's body is, Grandma said. If only they had given the body back to us, we could have given her a decent funeral.
The interesting thing about these stories is that they're all painful. They're painful every single time. And so when I would hear my grandmother talk about how when she would hear from her grandmother these stories, her grandmother would cry and she would cry with her. And there we would be, and you know, tears welling up in her eyes and tears welling up in my eyes, and we're in the same space each and every time. So the stories are painful, and they don't get any easier to tell. They don't get any easier to hear. And that's one of the lessons, I think, from the Dakota commemorative marches as well, is that I thought that after repeated tellings and engaging with these stories regularly, that there would be a time when we felt healed, perhaps, when we felt some of the pain go away, and it hasn't. And in fact, I think it's only intensified.
I have a theory. It appears to me that this was made about 1902.
Why do you say 1902?
Wes, I have something I think will put a little perspective on this.
Wow. What Jim tells me gives me an answer for Nancy. I want to show you something. This is an image I know very well because I have sold it at auction at least twice. And so you can now see what is on your spoon is basically copied from this image.
Yes, that's it.
I tell Nancy her grandmother's spoon was, in fact, a souvenir. But why such a disturbing image had been celebrated in such a manner wasn't clear until I finally met someone whose grandparents had lived through the uprising and its aftermath.
Wes, this is a beer tray produced for the Standard Brewing Company of Mankota, Minnesota in 1902, depicting the execution of the Sioux Indians. 1902 would have been the 40th anniversary of the event. I suspect that the spoon dates from the same period.
So now that you've got all this information, how does it make you feel about your spoon?
That is quite a story. The background is horrible.
It's a story that I think probably 99.9% of Americans don't know about.
Thank you. On December 24th, 1862, our company, with AC and K of the 6th Infantry Minnesota Volunteers, left Glencoe to assist in the hanging the 38 condemned Indians at Mankato. We made about 12 miles the first day and stopped overnight near some German farmers a few miles south of New Auburn. We were provided with a few teepees, or regulation tents, where 20 to 25 could easily crowd together. During the night, we had a heavy rain, which lasted until morning. During the later part of the night, the water ran right in the tent and under us, so most of us were soaked through to the skin before we had any warning. About daybreak, it turned bitterly cold, so our heavy clothes became stiff as paper collar on a dude in a large city. And to pull down our large tents was a terrible job. After having partaken of a little coffee, bacon, and hardtack, we started towards St. Peter and arrived there about noon. A mile or so below town, we passed the once notorious place called Traverse des Sioux, where the government had large warehouses from which the Indians had their annuity dealt out to them several times a year. This agency was established very early, and many important treaties between the Indians and the whites were made at this place. It was abandoned years ago, and only portions of decayed brick walls were left. We passed through St. Peter about noon Christmas Day, crossed the Minnesota River on a ferry, 3 miles above, and marched to the stone piles called Kasota, where we found a few vacated houses, where a roasted turkey would not have tasted very bad, but none was forthcoming. The next morning, December 26th, we started for Mankato, 6 or 7 miles distant, and arrived there about 9 a.m. I will now let another author speak about the tragic event more fully.
While he was in prison awaiting execution, Hidanyanka, also known as Rattling Runner, wrote an angry letter to his father-in-law, Chief Wabasha.
Wabasha, you have deceived me. You told me if we followed the advice of General Sibley and gave ourselves up to the whites, all would be well. No innocent man would be injured. I have not killed, wounded, or injured a white person, a white man, or any white persons. I have not participated in the plunder of their property. And yet today I am set apart for execution and must die in a few days, while men who are guilty will remain in prison. When my children are grown up, let them know that their father died because he followed the advice of his chief, and without having the blood of a white man to answer to the Great Spirit. My wife and children are dear to me. Let them not grieve for me. Let them remember that the brave should be prepared to meet their death, and I will do as becomes a Dakota.
On our last day in Minneapolis, my mother and I go to Fort Snelling in St. Paul. It takes us a while to find it. It's an exit near the airport, and we keep missing it somehow, and ending up near the airfield. When we finally hit the right exit, we park on a rise overlooking the juncture where the Minnesota River meets the Mississippi, forming a fork. This point is sacred to the Dakota, who call it Bidote, which means joining of two bodies of water. Legend has it that the Dakota people were formed by Inamaka, which translates as Earth Mother, at this place. And Bidote is also, now, the site of Fort Snelling, where 1,600 Dakotas were held for several months in such awful circumstances that many historians unhesitatingly call it a concentration camp. One Dakota man was quoted as saying the place is a site of our genesis and our genocide. There have been protests against the existence of the fort. Advocates for Indian rights argue that it should be torn down and reclaimed by the Dakota as farmland. My mother and I bypassed the fort, where guides in 19th century costumes stand at the entrance. We walk down a hill to a grove of trees, where there is a small circle with stakes driven into the ground. Pieces of cloth attached to the stakes and also tied around branches of the trees have Dakota names written on them by hand. I assume these are the names of the people held at the camp. The location is unmarked, and the site itself is unremarkable. There is a path and the stakes, but little else to set it apart. Someone who didn't know the history could easily walk past it. Before we leave, we stop to look out over the point where the rivers meet. Three large birds emerge from the trees along the far bank and begin flying in lazily expanding circles higher and higher until they are above our heads. The sun is so bright that I have to squint to see them, and even then they seem always just out of sight. They seem to be shaped like hawks. My mother is convinced they are bald eagles. Just look at their wingspan, she says. It is true. These birds are huge. I follow them as they rise, expecting that they'll eventually come back down, but they don't. They continue to circle toward the sun until I lose sight of them completely. It is almost too easy to draw analogies here at Bidote or Fort Snelling between the natural and built environments, between the oppressor and the oppressed. I'm disappointed not to be able to verify the apocryphal story of my ancestors' revulsion to the execution. Where did that story come from? Whose overactive imagination was responsible for manufacturing it? Does it matter? In her 2003 book, Regarding the Pain of Others, Susan Sontag says that remembrance is an ethical act, but even she acknowledges that things get complicated when it comes to reconciliation. To reconcile, she writes, it is necessary that memory be faulted and limited.
Once I had a taste of what it means to freeze to death, and do not believe that it is the worst kind of death. In a severe Minnesota winter, I rode 12 miles without fur coat and with an ordinary overcoat. For a time, I suffered terribly from the cold. I had neither strength nor time to run to get warm. The 1 mile went after the other, and I thought, we'll soon be there, and soon I did not feel cold. But when I arrived, I was so stiff that when I tried to get out of the sleigh, I fell helpless to the ground. Some of our people in the Union settlement were users and lovers of strong drink. For that reason, I had many difficulties. Some immigrants had brought with them from Sweden a whiskey still, and soon they had the still going full blast in the woods, and all winter they had a good time in their way. We warned and exhorted, but it did not help. Then we decided to pray especially David's prayer. Destroy, O Lord, and divide their tongues. Not long thereafter, the owners became enemies and destroyed their equipment. I was told that, when one of them was about to break the last vessel, he cried, "Now I am doing what Carlson wants me to do." The same thing happened with the Baptists, who had caused us much unpleasantness. We prayed, and they were divided and moved away.
So this was billed as a Q&A between Claire and myself, and then we were going to open up to the audience. But I think we've decided that we will just open it up to the audience right away, and I can ask questions, intersperse questions, or not, depending on how many questions you have. So comments, responses, questions that you'd like to ask Claire?
It actually was a slur. I think the full word was a Chippewa word, which is Nadasasu, I think. And then the French heard the Dakota referred to that way. It actually means snake. And so when the French heard that, they just assumed that was their name. So the Dakota obviously prefer to be referred to by their real name. But in the, you know, it kind of goes back and forth still, so. Yeah. What happened was, I sort of started off by explaining this, that one of my cousins was doing this kind of genealogical research and had discovered that a few of my uncles and also my great 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 grandfather were in the Civil War, and it's funny because I think when my mother first told me about it, initially it was that it started off very honorable, like they joined specifically to fight the Confederacy, and then gradually it unfolded that in fact, no, they joined to fight the Dakota. And as I learned more and more about their role and about the fact that they had witnessed and actually stood guard during this execution, it just was too fascinating and embroiled for me not to keep looking into it. And then when I found out about the articles and that he'd actually written this memoir, I was thrilled because I thought, well, this will really explain everything. And then in fact, it actually made it even more mysterious. So I don't know if that really answers the question about the personal connection, but the personal connection is what led me to the broader history. Yeah. Yeah, that kind of, it happened somewhat organically. Initially, I wanted to try to write it as a straightforward essay, but you know, I think I encountered some of the same difficulty that my ancestor encountered, which was that the story was so much bigger than me. And one of the things that it's in the essay, but we didn't talk about in the presentation as much, is that what you really kind of discover when you start researching Indian history generally is how these stories feel like they really belong to the Indians, that they have, they don't, they kind of have ownership of them. And so it feels uncomfortable to tell their story. So that's why I wanted to not to try to represent their point of view through my words, but use their own words. And then what was kind of ironic was that is, in some ways, I was kind of echoing what my ancestor did, because he basically cobbled together all these different accounts. But of course, none of his accounts are from the Dakota, but yet they were, newspaper reports and, official records and that sort of thing. So it's sort of kind of naturally, I decided that his approach was actually sort of the best approach. That Cesura or Lacuna is just, it's still there. You know, I still don't really know what he experienced, and it just seemed pointless to try to recreate it.
I could actually build on that and say that I've seen a few different versions of this text over the past couple months, and the initial version you shared with me was much more kind of collage-based and much more nonlinear, disjunctive, and then this most recent version that you share tonight had a pretty strong narrative quality, tying those collage elements together and more personal kind of details. And I'm just wondering how you made that shift. Were you uncomfortable with a substantially disjunctive text and you wanted to kind of make it more coherent, or was there a little bit more building what you said that, you know, you wanted to keep the emphasis on kind of your own perspective so as not to appropriate other histories, or what shifted over the past couple months?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely, like I said, you know, I started by trying to write it as just an essay, like this kind of personal account. And I felt like that was still relevant. Like, I didn't want to just cobble together something from historical accounts, that the present was as relevant as the past. It just come together in a way that felt natural. So in some ways, going back to revisit how it came together, it's hard because it didn't really, I mean, I think at one point I wanted to make it in the form of a map and have different accounts correspond to different sites that my ancestor traveled while he was participating in the Dakota War. It just wasn't working. So then I just decided to go with a more fragmentary process. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was the end of it, yeah. And I did email her and apologize, but I haven't heard back, and so far, that's the end. Hopefully that's not the real end, but yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I guess I felt really, I was apologizing for my ignorance, but that's a really good question. You know, I didn't really, maybe that's not something I should apologize for. But I did feel like, suddenly we'd asked this woman to go out of her way to talk to us and to explain this history to us that, you know, we could have learned on our own. And it just seemed like we'd, sort of inconvenienced her, and then to confess our own ignorance, I just felt stupid. So that's why I apologize. Jeremy, and then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it exists. That was definitely real. That was from a PBS special called History Detectives. And what I, you know, it was one of the first things that came up when I Googled this. And what I like about it is how it kind of parallels my own story of that, you know, for her, the spoon was passed down from her grandmother. And I like the fact that it's sort of, it's similar to what I was doing, but yeah, so I just thought that was nice. Yeah.
I wanted to come back to the conversation that you were having with the blog, because the way that I read that was not that she was uncomfortable with her ignorance about her experience, but that she was uncomfortable, because in the narrative it appeared as if your mother revealed to her that it was your relative who was present with the execution.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, in my potential misreading this, opening up the door into, as soon as I experienced her discomfort in that manner, I wonder what your impulse was behind her discomfort. Like, you know, broader, realm, you know, ancestral complicity, historicizing all.
Yeah. To answer the first part of your question is she definitely knew, because when I emailed her, I let her know exactly why I wanted to talk to her. And I asked her actually during the interview whether other descendants had approached her or the Dakota with sort of like a personal, like, I'm ashamed or, you know. And she said they had, but it didn't really mean anything, that from her point of view, apologies are just words, and all she wants is land. Like, literally, she would say, land. That's all that she's interested in. And it's, I don't think she's not entirely dismissive of people who want to say that they're sorry that this happened, but at the same time, it's not really, you know, it's just empty words. So, and then I think for the second part of your question, I think that, yeah, I did, that in doing this project, there is kind of some hope for redemption, I guess, when I heard the initial story about, I have no idea where that story came from, about my ancestor throwing up, and all the other troops apparently throwing up when the hanging took place, that for me that was a form of redemption, that because he had this really physical and human reaction to seeing 38 people die, that was kind of a sense of him recognizing them as humans and fellow humans and not just animals. Because they wanted to execute, you know, 300, over 300, which is just, you know, a much larger number. But so, anything else? Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, my feeling is that most people do not know about this happening, and there's an interesting, the reasons for that are interesting in themselves, but I think that bringing some exposure to it is important, and so I see that on some level as helping, I guess, but, you know, yeah, but ultimately, I suppose I would... to do what WAS wants would be to more actively fight for land reclamation, which would include, I guess, the Black Hills and South Dakota or something along those lines. So everyone should donate money to that cause. There will be a PayPal link on the Triple Canopy.
Did you, you obviously did archival work. Did you have a sense that other people had been in these archives recently, or did you have any sense from talking to people, the archivists, if this was material that anybody else was working with, or
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that the, next year is the 150th anniversary. And, you know, it's definitely within Minnesota. It is, I mean, at the Minnesota Historical Society, it has its own section. So, you know, they're certainly well thumbed through archives. But, and another person I interviewed who is a law professor who wrote about the trials, which is another fascinating story in itself. When I told her about these newspaper articles, she asked for copies of them. So I think, you know, there are people who are just actively studying this stuff all the time and constantly looking for new information. Yeah, I think when there were like I mentioned that there were these sort of flashes of wit, and I felt like there is in that side of the family like this some kind of a dry sense of humor, and so that was like a moment when I thought like I can sort of picture being actually related to this guy, but most of the time it just seems so remote that they feel like strangers. The other thing that I would say add about that is how incredibly hard it must have been to be a pioneer, and that when he describes stuff like, you know, sleeping, you know, outdoors and you know, night after night, and having very little to eat, it's just like I can't relate at all. It just feels like a science fiction almost. It's that foreign. So and that's just kind of bizarre to realize that, you know, just a few generations ago that was true. That was just normal. So that was weird. I mean, for me, that's the only benefit, honestly. I mean, I know my cousin wouldn't want it. Hear that, but I wasn't really that interested, and you know, maybe kind of mildly like, oh, that's interesting, they were pioneers in Minnesota, but you know, it just doesn't feel like it's a story that's true for so many people that it didn't make me feel unique or special. And then, and even this, I mean, there are countless other troops who were present, and they also tried to write about it after. You know, but his memoirs are more extensive than any others that I found, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, I don't know if that really answers your question, but I don't know. He just doesn't feel. I know he is related to me, but I don't really, at the same time, feel like he is.
You said earlier that you realized your text was replicating kind of how he had constructed his text. What point did you realize that?
Pretty soon. Really? I mean, yeah, it became clear pretty quickly that was, I was replicating what he had done, yeah.
And you were okay with that, or you were frustrated by that?
No, actually it felt right, yeah. But and it helped me kind of understand too why he may have done that.
Right.
Huh. So maybe, okay. One last question? Okay, two more questions. Thank you. I think that, you know, a couple years ago, she and a few other people founded this commemorative march to remember not just the 38 who were hung, but the 1,600 who were displaced. And what she told me is that it just didn't work in the way that she'd hoped. That they, and I think this is quoted in her interview, that she that we played, that she thinks that in fact, you know, it made things worse. That it kind of the settlers became, or the contemporary Minnesota people became, even who care about this kind of thing, were more entrenched, and in fact wrote counter histories. You know, saying why the Dakota War happened because the Dakota were killing all these white people and blah, blah, blah. And so I think from her point of view, I don't actually think that because the commemorative march failed, I think that she has redirected her focus to more concrete political goals, like land reclamation. And I think, you know, but I do still think it's definitely a galvanizing a factor. And none of these people would have been displaced if the war hadn't happened. So, I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but okay. Yeah. Okay, last question. Well, what we read is basically the essay, so that will appear pretty much as we presented it. And the images, I don't really know yet how they'll look on the website. So that's all being worked out. So, but the essay is more or less it's in a close to final state. So, and that's what you heard. Okay, so that's it.
Thank you.